Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Alice Fulton. Fulton is the Anne S. Bowers Professor of English at Cornell University. She has produced 6 volumes of poetry, including her award-winning 2001 volume, Felt. Her awards also include a fellowship from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Earlier this month, she published her first book of fiction, The Nightingales of Troy, Stories of One Family Century, published by Norton. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tish. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Now, I want to begin with this. You're primarily known as a poet and a short story writer. So did The Nightingales of Troy come from a short story or a poem and then build from there?
Well, no, it didn't come from a poem, no. I had a notion that I wanted to do something very different that you can't really do as well in poetry. So it came, the title story, you mean the whole book, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
Really, it came from people I knew and loved. It came from my aunts and my mother's family and stories that my mother had told me. So it's more character-driven than poetry ever would be.
Uh-huh. And it is set in your hometown of Troy. So why did you decide to make this fiction instead of memoir or autobiography?
Well, it's true. A lot of poets write memoir and autobiography. I think I'd find that really difficult. I find it harder to tell the absolute truth than to play around with the truth. I think, especially because some of the stories I was interested in telling, I didn't know completely. There were secrets, family secrets. And if I tried to tell the truth, it would have been very boring because it would have stopped at the good part. Like, what happened there? And I never knew. But fiction gave me a chance to solve or try to have fun with some of those secrets that had never been told. And it's very much fun to answer the questions and sometimes to make things go right that had been maybe wrong. And to, you know, you have emotions when you write this stuff, and you can feel, oh, I put that one to shame, didn't I? Or I really fixed his wagon.
Did you ever censor yourself, though? I mean, are there living relatives that you were writing about? I know this covers an entire century, but obviously family members are here and there, aren't they?
Yes. Well, most of the people I write about are no longer here. My mother is. My mother's one of the characters in the book, and she's still with us, which, of course, is wonderful. But in the book, she's a nurse, which she was in her own life. And she's very heroic, and I don't think there would be much that she would complain about. She's funny. She's a funny character and very strong and independent, which she is in real life as well. So in her case, I don't think she would have taken offense.
Uh-huh. And did you find yourself rewriting some of your family history to make it look better or different?
It's very different because it isn't a memoir, so I had this freedom. And for example, in the first story, I just had a bit of knowledge there, and it was that my mother was born on a farm, and she always had a great line, and it was, "I gave birth to myself." And the reason she said that was that her mother was alone when she was born on the farm. Her mother had no one there during the moment of the hours when she was giving birth, except for her younger sister, her little girl, was there with her, who's one of the other characters in the book. So all I knew was that my mother had been born in that way, which was, you know, sort of dramatic and had potential. And from that, I made up a whole story that has other...
Built from there.
Yeah, built from a tiny thing, really.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. So the book does begin in 1908, as you were saying, when you do introduce Mamie Flynn Garahan. So talk to us a little bit about that, and then I'd love to have you read the first chapter.
Okay, I'll just read the first paragraph, because I don't want
the first
to...
Paragraph,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, Mamie Flynn Garahan, that was based on my grandmother, and I never knew her at all, but my mother had told me stories about her. In the book, in the fiction, she's wonderfully independent, and she, again, is funny. She's very down to earth. She is a woman who is pragmatic and knows how to get things done. People call her Mamie Come Runnin', because when anything needed to be done, she's the one they would call to go and do, as she says. So she's this person where all throughout the story, there's somebody saying, "Mother, come running. The horses are back." Or, "Mamie, come running. The nun has fallen." You know, and there she'd be, and she'd take off at a good clip down the road. And so she was sort of a country woman who was very strong. And she's the one who gave birth alone to the woman who turned out to be my mother. So I can just read the first paragraph of this story, which is called Happy Dust. And it's called that because, well, I was reading about actually drugs around the beginning of the century because of childbirth, what was given for the pain and so on. What could she do? So I found out that there was a product called Bayer Heroin. Actually, the Bayer Aspirin Company used to manufacture for about 10 years at the beginning of the century Bayer Heroin, and you could buy it.
And it really was heroin?
It was really, opium. It was heroin. And had lion on the packet and so on. So it was called colloquially Happy Dust. And one of the things I really enjoy about writing fiction is just the expressions of the time period, each time period. So the story is called Happy Dust from that drug. And also it's, of course, the notion of mortality and, you know, dust. Happy Dust. In the 20th century, I believe there are no saints left. But our farm on Bog Road had not yet entered the 20th century. At that time, around 1908 it would be, I had a secret I could tell to no one, least of all a saint or an arsenic eater. In my experience, it is better to keep away from saints unless you have business with them. The same backbone that makes them holy virtuosos makes them eager to mind other people's P's and Q's. But some of the saints I knew were family, and this made them hard to fend off. Don't think I am speaking of my sister-in-law, Kitty. She was not a saint, but a lost soul.
I love that line. That's the poet in you coming out.
The lost soul. Well, I think there are a number of saints in the book, or would-be saints, or people who don't want to be saints but are forced into that role.
Uh-huh.
So one of the subjects, I think, is that notion of goodness and the possibility of goodness and the difficulties of trying to be good and the danger, even, because we often hear about the problem of evil, but we don't hear about the problem of goodness. And I think it is a problem in a way because there are limits to altruism.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get hurt while serving others, as one of the characters says later in the book. But in that first paragraph, there's the reference to an arsenic eater. And again, it's the drugs, but I found out in my research that there was this old beauty regimen that in the 19th century, certain women, and I suppose it was women of a certain class who could afford to do this and who cared about this kind of thing, would eat a little bit of arsenic every day to make themselves pale.
Fascinating. That really drew me in the book when I saw it.
Who knew? You know, who knew? But so there's this character, Kitty, who eats a little bit of arsenic every day to maintain her beautiful, ghostly pallor.
And in reality, she was probably sicker than a dog, right?
Well, it made
her getting sicker.
It's funny. It's funny. It's sort of, I suppose it had an enervating effect. But it people, women actually managed to be okay with it. You could eat a little bit and you weren't too taken away by it. You know, actually they were okay.
Huh.
Didn't poison them.
I guess not. Now, as you were saying, this book does take us through the whole 20th century. So how did you do some of the research? I know some of this does take place in your hometown of Troy, but did you go back and dig through, you know, libraries and archives and so on?
Yes, I had the best time doing that. I, you know, that's the danger. One of the dangers is you get so caught up in writing, doing the research and reading these fascinating things that you'd never write the story. So for some of this book, I was living in Michigan, and I sent away and got the Troy Record newspaper from Troy, New York, on microfilm,
mm-hmm.
microfiche.
Mm-hmm.
And I would read it and look for the articles. And in the first story, I don't think that was my, that probably wasn't my source. But for some of them, it was. For the very first story I wrote in the book, the first one that I wrote that started me writing the book, I was looking into my great-grandmother. And I was looking through the newspaper, the Troy Record, and I found her death notice, and I knew nothing about her, absolutely nothing. And I discovered that she died in a very startling, strange way. They used to have long obituaries, and, well, I won't give it away because it would be a plot spoiler, because I write about it, but it was startling to find out what happened to her. And that got me thinking, she's from Ireland, and I began thinking about her and her life and making up a story to explain the circumstance of her death, which I had read in the obituary.
Mm-hmm.
So I used that for research, and I wrote a story about the nurse in the 1930s, and that for that I used the Journal of American Nursing, which was just amazing. From the 1930s. It had all the old medicines that We no longer...
I'm fascinated interesting. By all medical techniques as well.
Oh, yes.
Crazy, crazy things people live through.
Yes, and sad, because yeah. reading this was just heartbreaking in the 1930s when, you know, the Depression, and mm-hmm. so sad, the case histories that were reported, but, you know, it was before antibiotics. So you can imagine what was happening to people if they got pneumonia. That was very, very serious. And my mother was the nurse who was treating the patients, and she had told me how they treated the pneumonia patients.
And it's horrific to us now.
Yeah, it's so scary. I used that, the Journal of American Nursing, and then my mother, of course. And mm-hmm. It was great. I loved doing the research.
Yeah, well, I can tell by there's a sense in the book. There's a sense of joyousness, and even you discovering new things, I can tell. Now, it is a generation of mainly women. Well, why did you decide to focus in mainly on women?
Yeah, I think there were probably two reasons. And one is that my own family that I was raised in, and the people I was using for the book as my characters, the basis of my characters, my aunts, well, of course, they were women. And I was raised mostly in a family of women. Mm. The only man who was around me was my father. And he died when I was 20.
Oh.
But I was a family of women, so I knew that culture. And the second reason was I really have felt, you know, that women's experience is so interesting, and perhaps has been, over the course of literature, has been underreported, and that there hasn't been quite enough said about the secret lives, the private lives. And it's an odd statement, because a lot of course, literature is about women, but I still feel, even the nature of the question is sort of why these people, you know, and I've wondered whether male writers are asked, why do you write about men?
Mm.
You know, because it's sort of given that, okay, that is the human experience, that is universal. Of course you're writing about men. But I do hear, why do you write about women? And I think it's because they need to be written about.
Uh-huh.
I think these people especially that I write about were undocumented lives. They left nothing in writing. I couldn't even find a greeting card that these people had left. Mm-hmm. I think I found one from my grandmother, and it was signed, you know, Love Mother in a Rush. And that was the story of their lives.
Wow.
They were always...
They're still invisible. You know, I don't care what anybody says. You're right about that.
Yeah. And especially, this whole generation mm-hmm. of people who weren't English professors. You know, they were just people who tried to make a living. They're waitresses, I guess I had no hairdressers, but waitresses, nurses. I had a few other professions in there. But there were people who had no time to write. And they didn't keep diaries the way today a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
In their day, it was not fashionable to, especially encouraged, to do that. So in a way, I felt like I was giving voices and finding experiences that needed to be said. And when I wrote about, say, a story set in the early part of the century, the second decade of the century, it's in the voice of my great-grandmother, who's Irish, or based on her, I should say,
mm-hmm.
a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my questions was, well, what has not been said in literature from that decade? You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of great literature, but I thought, well, what about the sort of sexual thoughts of her life? I don't mean that she had erotic thoughts, but her whole sensual experience, her approach when she was proposed to late in life at the age of 66, for her that was late in life, and what was her feeling when she got that marriage proposal? You know, what would be her real feeling, not to romanticize it? So I did try to come up with experiences that I felt hadn't been maybe articulated so much in literature.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alice Fulton. She's a writer and poet, and she's just published a new book of fiction called The Nightingales of Troy, Stories of One Family Century. Now, did you find any secrets about your family that you decided not to reveal?
Oh, I didn't think whether there's anything I didn't. Yeah, I think what I did more than not reveal things was I took what I thought was very important, and some of the secrets I found out or things I did know mm-hmm. were big life events.
Mm.
You know, there are suicides in the book. There's madness, some dark areas of experience. But what I did to protect people was to fictionalize around them so that the characters would change, and it couldn't be placed exactly who it happened to, or the events would change in such a way that it wasn't exactly what happened. But it's really an ethical point, you know, how much do you reveal? And I think, as I thought about it too, I always tried to, this is going to sound really corny, but I tried to write from love, mm-hmm. and it was kind of easy because I did love these people. But even when I was writing about people who did things that were maybe considered shameful, like suicide. I felt it was important to write about that because I feel that sometimes there's a judgment brought to bear on the person who does it. And having been close to a number of people who made that terrible choice, I have to say I understood why they did it in a way. And, you know, I just wanted to show how good they were and how missed they are, and also show motivation. And so I felt I couldn't leave it out, even though it was a secret, and it was a secret that people didn't talk about. I wanted to speak about it precisely because it was something that no one wanted to talk about, that people looked away from, and perhaps there wasn't cultural even understanding of that.
Well, I would think also you're talking about an Irish family. Catholicism is notoriously condemning of suicide.
Right, it was.
It still is.
Yeah, that was in one of my stories where the character couldn't be buried in the Catholic graveyard because she was a suicide.
Yeah, I've heard those stories too. I have Irish grandmother.
Oh, okay.
From County Cork.
Oh, me too, County Cork.
It did take you a good number of years to write this book, I assume, right? Were the stories coming out slowly?
Yes.
Before you could put the whole thing together?
Yes, it took me so long, I'm ashamed.
You don't need to be ashamed.
Maybe this would give other writers heart. You know, that it took me a long, long time, and you just have to plow through it and don't give up on it. I was slowed down, too, because I kept stopping to write other things.
I was going to ask you that. Did you find poems seeping out while you were writing this? Because it's very poetic, the way you write this book, even though it is fiction.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't want to give up that language, you know, which I love about language, that you can make it beautiful. But yeah, I was writing poetry at the same time and publishing a couple of poetry books while I was writing this, and a book of essays. So that slowed me down. And I guess one bit of advice is to other writers, don't do that.
Really?
Don't write four books at a time, because they're all going to get slowed down. It's better if you can just focus, I think, and finish a book. But in my case, I didn't. I put it aside and wrote poetry and wrote essays. So it took me a really good long time to write this book. But I couldn't have written it all at the beginning. It added something, because things happened, I found out more, and the writer I was when I wrote the very first story, I wasn't that writer anymore by the time I wrote the last one. I had learned a little bit more, I think, about technique and about how to write a story. So while the first one has a kind of impulsive, I hope spontaneous, kind of beginner's quality that I see in my students' work when they start, you know, there's a kind of freshness you can't teach. And I hope that my first story has some of that. But by the time I got to the end, I had learned, so I was more in control of technique, I think. So actually the whole book changed because of the way I wrote it.
Yeah, it seems like a whole. It didn't seem
well,
like
good.
An amateur in the beginning. So let's talk about the title story, The Nightingales of Troy.
Okay.
Tell us a little about it, and then I'd like to have you read something from it.
Okay. Well, The Nightingales of Troy, nightingales refers, of course, to the bird, and Troy refers to Troy, New York. There are no nightingales in Troy, New York, because they're European songbirds, and also they go to other parts of the world, but they don't come to North America. So nightingale is kind of an emblem, and it's a notion of things that maybe are missing from these old post-industrial cities. A notion of, I left it very open so readers can figure it out for themselves and think about it. I even thought of a new thing it might really be meaning today. I didn't think about it too much, that aspect. But it's, I think, an emblem of beauty where there is none. You know, Troy, New York was never, when I was growing up there, it was a very gritty city. It's an old factory town. And I always found it incredibly poignant, and I did find beauty there in the bricks and the old mills and so on. But nightingales became an emblem for the beauty that we heard that we would never see, the songs that we heard, and maybe the tales that were told of beauty that might be elsewhere, that might be the exotic beauty, that might not be here, that we were reaching toward and straining toward. And the other aspect of it, I think, was memory, that it's the past. The nightingale is the archaic bird from the 19th century, poetic from poems. And it's something you read about in poetry, but at least as an American growing up in Troy, I never saw a nightingale. And in the book, people are always thinking they do. You know, they say, I saw a nightingale in Lansingburg last night, or last night I heard the nightingale. But the other meaning that was very important for the book of nightingale is Florence Nightingale and the nurses and the caregivers and the women who take care of others in the tradition of Florence Nightingale, whether they're young women taking care of their aging parents or whether they're actually professional nurses, RNs, taking care of their patients. So the title story, it focuses on Annie, who is the nurse in the book and based on my mother, and it takes place in the 1930s, the Depression, in Lansingburg, New York, the Nightingales of Troy. The visiting nurse had been waiting 10 minutes for her last case of the day, a has-been priest. Her raccoon coat was folded inside out on a chair, and she'd placed a clean newspaper under her black bag. When she opened the Venetian blinds, hygienic winter light glazed the oilcloth and dresser scarves of the Phoenix Hotel. How far could that Jesuit get with his halting gait and metabolic disease? She kept her eyes peeled. If he turned up, she'd ask him why God made the Depression. Annie Garahan was vehement with things that had given her the slip. That's just the first paragraph.
That's great. You know, these women, so many of them are so eccentric. Now, the big question for me is, who are you in this book? You must be in it, right?
Here I'm revealing everybody else, but, I want to stay hidden.
Who are in this book?
Well, there's a character that I, of course, drew upon my own experiences, and it's the youngest character in the book. Ruth is her name.
And Livingston, right?
Ruth Livingston, yes. I think I came to those stories a little bit later, and that was a good thing, that I wrote them later in the process of the book, because the hardest thing was to write about a character based on myself. It was far easier to look at other people and make things up and be objective and get their gestures and their voices and their manner of speaking in the slang, but to look at yourself is so hard.
But as a poet, you've been doing that all your life, don't you think?
No.
Really?
No, I don't think so, because what I've been looking at as a poet is much more about language and feeling and ideas.
Ah.
But I never looked at myself as a character and actually said, well, what are my faults? Because when you're writing about a character in fiction, you've got to show what's wrong with them, their cracks, you know, their their weak points, and they can't be perfect or no one would believe them. So you've got to take a hard look at yourself and actually make fun of yourself in a way. And I hope I did that with my character Ruth, who in some ways is based on me, and in other ways, of course, I drew upon other people and mixed that in too.
You know what, in one of the final chapters, Ruth Livingston is dealing with her mother's dementia.
Yes.
And she says this: they said time healed all wounds, but it shouldn't have healed this much. Time has gone too far. That is so beautiful. And what is this dementia? Is this something that's really in your family?
Yes. Yeah, that's actually based on truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've had experience as a caregiver.
Uh-huh.
And that's been, it's been difficult. It's very hard because, as my character says in the story.
It was beautifully put. Obviously, the poet wrote that.
Oh, well, thank you. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, time can heal too far, because then you begin losing the past and losing.
Yeah.
You don't want to lose too much of the wound of the bad stuff, because then you have no memory of how you got where you are. But, you know, caregiving, for me, it was a hard role to take. And it's hard for my character in the book, because I never wanted to be a nurse. That's my mother.
Yeah.
I never wanted to be a nurse, and so you have to draw upon parts of yourself that you never knew were there sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's what the character is trying to do at the end. She's trying to, bear up under this and make the best of it. And the person she's taking care of is just great, so that makes it easier, too.
Now, do you think the role of the writer is to take people to uncharted territory, or is it to help make the everyday more familiar? Did you have a thought about that?
I guess for me it would be to make the everyday less familiar.
Oh.
And that probably does come from poetry in a way, because it's as if we're so used to looking at things that we don't even see them anymore. We're inured to what we're experiencing. We don't see it freshly, and we don't really experience the moment. But one of the gifts, I think, of fiction or poetry is to be able to make us see it freshly and say, that is wonderful, or that is strange. I never thought about that, but that's truly amazing. So I think that's it, just to be able to say, this is great. I do it every day, and I never really thought about that so much. And the other part of your question, should it take us to uncharted territory? Was that the first? I think it should make us think in a deeper way, and that is uncharted territory. To make us think about experience maybe from a new angle and turn it around a little bit differently so that the uncharted territory isn't external. You know, it's not as if it has to be about a foreign country. It could be about Ithaca or it could be about Troy, New York. But it's to say, I never really thought of time that way. I never thought of memory quite that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been living it, but I never thought of that way to get through it. I never thought of that way to bear up under this. And I never thought of solving the problem that way. And I know somebody like this, but I never thought of laughing in this way and thinking, yeah, that could be funny what she does.
Did writing this book change you in any way in regard to your own autobiography and how you've looked at your life and do so now?
Oh, I think to write it, maybe I had to be able to look at myself more critically. I hope I could do that. And to stand back from myself and laugh at myself, maybe that was part of it. It does help you look at other people more carefully. Poetry, you don't need to do that. You could just look at language. And I've often said as a poet, you don't need the world at all. You could just the world could fall away. All you need is a good unabridged dictionary. Flannery O'Connor had a great line about that. She said, everybody who doesn't have enough to write about by the time they're 18 will never be a writer. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true in a way, because life gives you so much every day. You know, in Ulysses, of course, James Joyce's wonderful book, is all set in one day in Dublin. So it's as if one day gives you enough to write about. And if you go deep enough, if you go deeply into that, world, into the interior. Mm-hmm. So for me, fiction, I think, was a way of understanding that experience itself had a value. It wasn't just about language and feeling and ideas. That the nitty-gritty of life, the ordinary life, actually could be thought about in a deep way.
Uh-huh. We only have about a minute left. Well, what can we expect coming from Alice Fulton in the future? Any more poetry?
Yes, that's what I'm working on now. I'm gone back to poetry. And that, I think, will probably be my next book, will be poems.
Uh-huh. Are they going to be personal poems?
Yeah, they're always somewhat.
Language.
Even the language is personal, yeah. I mean, you can't get away from yourself in poetry, and who would want to, really? Because one thing I felt about writing is that we only have one chance to say our lives. We have only one chance to say it and to get our experience in. So writing is a way to say whatever is idiosyncratic and whatever you've noticed that no one else maybe has noticed in quite the same way. And whether it's poetry or fiction, for me as a writer, that's really what it's about, is to say what I believe and what I've lived.
Well, Alice Fulton, thank you so much for joining us. And again, the book is called The Nightingales of Troy, Stories of One Family's Century. Please go out and read it. It's great.
Thank you, Tish.
Alice.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.